That note, we'll just keep moving right along. Who do we have next? Maine Aquaculture Association, Sebastian Bell.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much. My name is Sebastian Bell. I come from Halliwell and I used to live in South Bristol. So my kids went to Lincoln Academy and it was a great school and it served them well. For those of you who were on the Maine Development Foundation tour, you've already got this folder. So you don't have to take a second one, but really appreciate you making the time for me today. The Maine Aquaculture Association is the oldest state aquaculture association in the country. We were founded in the 70s, and we were founded by a group of faculty and graduate students from University of Maine, University of New Hampshire, Bowdoin and Colby College. And all of those folks went on to found their own farms, and are many of them are still in the business as commercial growers in the state of Maine. We have a representative board of directors. So our members grow finfish, shellfish, and seaweed, and our board of directors is designed to represent both the species they grow, as well as the size of the company, as well as the production method they use. So as an example, in the case of oysters, we have three board members. One is a surface cage growing grower, one is a bottom culture grower, and one is a hatchery owner. So that's just an example of within each species group, how it's represented for the diversity purposes. And I think, if I recall correctly, over half of my board is women. And we have a tremendously active group of female entrepreneurs in the state who are growing companies. And that's a really kind of cool part of my world. Our members grow animals and plants both in freshwater and saltwater. So they grow both on land and in the ocean. And we have, by the latest account, I think we have an operation in every county in the state of Maine. Which is kind of interesting. So we do have some members that are way up in the mountains. They're using beautiful, high quality fresh water to raise salmon and trout. And then we have members that are down on the coast and are using both freshwater and saltwater. Probably one of the things which is not known about our sector, but is known at a national and international level, was the Maine Aquaculture Association was the first group of commercial growers actually in the world to come up with best management practices that were then third-party audited. So what that means is we come up with a series of methods that we use to grow our animals and plants. Those are focused on sustainability, and then we put those out to be audited by a third party. So in the case of, for example, Cook Aquaculture, which is our large salmon grower, they're certified by two international groups that come in and audit their farms, often on a monthly basis, to make sure that they are complying with their environmental standards. Those are over and above the regulations, right? So the standards are established by an international body, and then they're audited. And those are higher than the regulations we have here in the state. And we have a very robust regulatory environment in the state of Maine. As an example, we probably have the strictest fish health regulations in the country and in some cases in the world. And we should be proud of that. And your predecessors on this committee have been part of that, establishing those rules and regulations. And it protects us as farmers to make sure that there aren't people out there who are kind of cowboys or cowgirls not operating responsibly. You may have heard we've had some controversy around our sector, and we will continue to have controversy over the next couple of years. Glad to answer any questions about any of that. We have roughly 156 ocean farms in the state, and those go all the way from the New Hampshire border to the Canadian border. Then we have an additional 7-8 land-based operations. And you probably have heard we've got some larger land-based operations that are proposed. We have three of them that have been fully permitted. None of them has started construction yet. They probably, the one that will start construction first will be the one in Jonesboro. I think that'll be the first one that'll break ground. We employ 700 people, 725 people on a year-round basis. Jonesboro. I think that'll be the first one that'll break ground. We employ 700 people, 725 people on a year-round basis. And I had a great moment in one of my board meetings the other day where one of our younger members came to me and said, Sebastian, I've grown my company to the point where I can now offer benefits to my employees. And he's a mussel grower down in Casco Bay, and he was very proud of that fact. And I think that's kind of an indication of how our sector is growing. We've grown slowly but steadily. Some people will say that we're explosively growing, and I would say just look at the data and you'll see that we've averaged about 2% growth per year on it over the last 20 years. That's compared to about 8% per year annually at a global level. So our international competitors are growing much faster than we are, and we do compete in an international market. It's a little bit different than the lobster industry in the sense that lobstering, we land a lot of the lobster that's in the marketplace in this state of Maine. In our case, whether it's oysters, salmon, seaweed, mussels, we are infinitesimal compared to the production that happens in other places in the world. And so we have to compete against those companies. Many of those companies and countries don't have the kinds of environmental regulations or labor regulations that we have. And so the advantage we have is proximity to market. We are within a 24-hour truck drive of 130 million consumers. So that's Atlanta North, Chicago East. And that's the market that we compete in, is the East Coast fresh market. And we're very good at competing in that because we are so close to the market and because we come out of clean water in Maine. The Maine brand counts for a lot in the seafood industry. All of us who are in the seafood business are proud that we grow stuff or harvest stuff in Maine. And that high environmental quality is reflected, for us at least, in the marketplace. Typically, depending on whether you're talking about oysters, mussels, or salmon, we might get as much as 20, 25% more in terms of price in the marketplace than our competitors. And it's really because of the Maine brand, because we're so close to markets, because the environmental quality is so high here in Maine. We generate roughly between $80 and $100 million in gross revenues on an annual basis. So that's the point of first sale. So there's no multipliers in there. That's just what the farmer gets paid. That goes up and down because we have a kind of a unique salmon farming method in the state of Maine. In the year 2000, we shifted to a production method called all-in, all-out site rotation. And it's a method that's actually been used in the organic farming community for many, many years. And what it means is we stock a farm, we stock all the farms in a bay at the same time, we raise those fish up, and then we harvest them all at the same time, and we leave that bay fallow for about a year. So on any given year, 30% of our salmon farms are being fallowed in a site rotation. Since we did that, we've only used antibiotics twice, and that's quite an accomplishment if you compare our salmon farms to other salmon farms around the world. In the case of shellfish and seaweed, we're about to go back and redo our best management practices. They were done 15 years ago. The technology and the methods have evolved quite a bit, and so we're going to redo that. That will be an exercise that we will lead the growers through. They will develop their own best management practices, and then they will go out to scientific review to an expert panel to look at them and see whether or not they're up to snuff. I want to just highlight, and Jim Deal will appreciate this, state of Maine is very lucky. We have the best, bar none, research and development infrastructure for cold water marine aquaculture research in North America, not just in America, but including Canada. And a lot of that is with the university, the facilities they have, their expertise that they bring to bear. We use that all the time to solve problems that we're facing. Farming is farming. Every year is different, and every year brings a new challenge. And the university is really critical in helping us solve those problems. The three areas that we focus on from an association point of view are training of new farmers. So we're quite similar to MOFCA in the sense that we have programs that take new growers, train them in methods, make sure that they don't make the same mistakes that we did when we first started a long time ago. The development of best management practices, which I've talked about earlier, and then business support services. We have a full-time economist, Christian Braden. All he does is work with new farmers, helping them develop business plans, production plans, risk management plans, any sort of challenge that they might have as a new farmer. Christian will go to work on. And just as an example, one of the challenges we have as a sector is financing, because we're kind of new and a lot of people don't know about our business. So Christian developed the first set of what are called benchmarking studies in America. So he benchmarked all the different species and kinds of production methods we have. Those are now routinely used by the banking community. When somebody comes to the bank and says, we would like to apply for a loan to start an oyster farm, they pick up the benchmarking study and compare the application to that benchmarking. And it tells the bank whether or not that person is kind of in the ballpark for what where they should be from an economic performance point of view. The final piece I'll just leave you with is we as an association are very focused on strategic partners, strategic partnerships. The working waterfront community is comprised of a lot of different groups. And right from the very beginning, my board of directors has always been focused on how do we work with our colleagues of the working waterfront. We were one of the founding members of the Working Waterfront Coalition when it was founded many years ago. We founded also with some of our colleagues on the land side, the Natural Resources Network. That's a network that includes all the way from snowmobilers to forestry people to farming folks. I sit on the Fishermen Forum's board of directors. I do that because Fishermen's Forum is a really important event for all of us in the working waterfront. I sit on the National MAFAC Federal Advisory Committee, which advises NOAA Fisheries on policy at the national level. And I am currently, and this is one of those things where you be careful what you wish for, I'm the elected president of the National Aquaculture Association. That is an interstate association that we lobby and work on policy at a national level with all the states in the country, not just coastal states, but also inland freshwater states. I will stop there and thank you for your patience. You will see me a bunch of times this year. The only thing I will say, and Ben Martens alluded to this, probably if you were to ask me what our single biggest challenge is gentrification on the coastline and the shift in values in coastal communities around commercial use versus non-commercial use of the wonderful ocean that we're all privileged to see and live and work around. Gentrification is the biggest challenge for us. And it often drives the public debate around aquaculture. When you hear a lease coming up for renewal, when you hear a lease coming up for granting that DMR, Deirdre and Pat Kelleher, the commissioner, deal with, most of the time, the controversy around those applications has to do with the fact the communities, the people who live in those communities are not used to using the ocean for commercial purposes. And there's no mechanism in the law right now to allow for consideration of viewscape when those leases come up. And that's intentional. That's something that this legislative body has chosen for many, many years. It's come before this committee, it's come before this legislature many, many times over the years. And everybody, in at least historically, has said, we value working waterfronts and viewscapes is not a criteria that we are going to use to judge whether or not a project should or should not go forward. Thank you very much.
Representative Dudera.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm the one with all the questions today, huh?
It's usually Representative Thorne.
Yeah. Or Representative Stroud down there. She likes to ask her questions too. I'm not quite sure how to ask this, Mr. Bell, but I'm thinking about what a wonderful industry this is for young people. And when we were on the tour and we saw the video, I've met Shay Conover before when I represented Islesboro and seen her operation and the oyster guy up in Hancock. And it's just such a good entree. And there's so many, you know, young, energetic people working in this industry, and it's small, and it's, you know, we all feel so proud of it. But what seems to happen in a lot of cases in Maine is this is the way it starts. And then people come in from outside and it grows and it grows. And then the young folks maybe can't get into it anymore. And is this something you see on the radar? I know gentrification is a big issue, but is that something? And how are you maybe working, you know, to protect the industry? Although people have a right certainly to grow a business if they want to, as big as they want to, but
Yeah. So there are three things that we have in, and first of all, thank you for your question and a very fair question. And there are people who are concerned about the issue of consolidation and how, when you start small, you get bigger and bigger, and then the big guys take over and little guys get squeezed out, right? That's the concern. Maine has in statute provisions that would limit that ability. So as an example, the individual size of a lease cannot be over 100 acres. Okay, so that's one cap that we have. The second cap we have is the total number of acres that an individual company can lease. And always remember, this is a lease. This is not an ownership. This is something that can be revoked at any time by the state agencies that have jurisdiction over this sector. So if somebody does something bad, there's a process that you go through, not just with DMR, but in the case of FinFish, with DEP. So there's two agencies plus federal agencies that have the ability to revoke permissions. But so there's also a total cap on the number of acres that an individual company could lease. That total cap is 1,000 acres. But in order to get over 500 acres, you as a company have to file with the DMR a site rotation and fallowing plan, right? So you can't go over that 500 acres unless you've got a site rotation and fallowing plan with the Department of Marine Resources, and they approve it. They review and approve it. The reason for that cap was because when those limits were put in place, we were shifting to the site rotation and fallowing process with the salmon farming. And so we knew that we had three bays in the state that all had salmon farms in them. In order to make sure that we didn't have to lay people off every year, we wanted to allow a company to have more than the 500 acres. Currently, Cook Aquaculture has roughly over 600 acres. By the way, that's the size of an average potato farm in Aroostook County, just for the record, right? So the total number of acres in the state of Maine is 1,750 acres that we lease. That's three potato farms. But that cap was put in place to prevent that kind of large kind of coming in and taking over everything. And then the final thing, which is, I think, very important, and unless you really are in the minutiae and read the rules and regulations very exactly, Maine has an anti-speculation clause in their aquaculture leasing, which means that you cannot just acquire leases to speculate in a market to sell those off to somebody else. And that's really important. And that's actually, that anti-speculation clause was put in place a long time ago. We've supported it always because we don't want to see that kind of, you know, consolidation over time. But the other side of this is, in order to compete in an international market, scale is important, right? In order, we have no choice. We're not competing against a bunch of people from another country that have a limit on the size of the company they can have. And so we have to have the ability to scale over time. But it's I think, and obviously I'm an advocate for the sector, but I have worked all over the world. I've worked in a lot of other places that don't have those kinds of limits, and that kind of consolidation does happen. And I don't think that's necessarily healthy for a sector. You want a diversity of company sizes, of operational sizes. The most interesting thing for me, and we learned this in COVID, and this was completely unexpected on our part, and Ben alluded to this earlier, when COVID hit, restaurants shut down. 80% of seafood in the country was consumed in restaurants prior to COVID. 80%. So our markets evaporated overnight. The only people who had really good entry into the retail side of the seafood business were the larger companies, because they had relationships with Hannaford, with Food Lion, and so what happened was our large growers turned to our smaller growers and said, hey, we've got a market for what you have. Let us distribute your product through our company. If we had not had that diversity of company size, the larger companies and the smaller companies, we would have lost growers. We expected to lose 30% of our small growers in COVID, and we only lost one. And it was really because of that partnership between the larger growers and the smaller growers that helped us survive. So diversity in company size is really important, I think, for resilience in the sector. Long answer. I apologize, but yeah.
Representative Strout?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I couldn't get away with three or four people speaking without a question. So Your lucky day. So there's salmon pens off Beals, which is part of my district. And I know they did not increase some of their lease. There's conversations about them enlarging their lease. I don't know what their specs are. And then there's also concern around Frenchman's Bay with some projects that they're not real happy about pens going in there. And some of those conversations are because they've removed pens from other parts of the country. And it's all the science that you find and get and look at, right? So there is some controversy with that, especially in my area. So how is that going and how are you working with the locals, not just the pamphlets, but when they do that scientific research themselves, how are you kind of working with them together?
So I'm much to my staff's horror, I never say no. So if somebody reaches out to me and says, we've got a question or concern, we sit down with them and we go through what their concerns are. And as an example, you will probably see a bill in front of you this session that's backed by a group called Oceana. We had their campaign manager come to our offices and sit down with our board and present to our board. And we listened to Matt Dumas. We would do that with anybody. We are a very small organization, and I will just be very frank with you. Our bandwidth, in terms of our ability to go to every coastal community and have a discussion with them, is pretty limited. But we did, my board agreed to hire a full-time staff person. Her name is Afton Vigu. She comes from a lobster. She's a her dad still lobsters. Her brother still lobsters. She comes from, I think, a fifth generation lobster family. And her job description is to go and talk to communities about what their concerns are. Having said that, I will say that, and so my first degree is in fisheries biology, second in agricultural economics. I spend a lot of time reading data and scientific studies, peer-reviewed stuff. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And the challenge, I think, for people who aren't in the field in particular is sorting through the misinformation and the scientific, you know, stuff. So I will say this. The proposal in Frenchman's Bay that moved forward and that was rejected by DMR had a lot of issues with it. And if that company had come and talked to people in the sector who were familiar with Maine and kind of knew what the landscape was and what the technical considerations, and most importantly, what the actual law and rules and regulations were that would be used to review that proposal, I think they probably would have chosen somewhere else to put that project. The thing I think, fair disclosure, I worked for DMR for 3 years, many, many years ago. It was one of the most educational periods in my life. I was always the private sector guy pounding on the table saying, you bureaucrats are trying to put me out of business, my digger. When I worked for DMR, I realized how challenging it is to be a public servant and to actually balance all the different, you know, demands on you. I think DMR does an amazing job of being fair, of looking at the science, being neutral, and really pushing companies to do the right thing in the application process. For anybody who's ever applied for a lease, you know that it can take up to 3 or 4 years to get through the leasing process. Nobody in their right mind would go through that process with an application that they didn't think might have a chance of being successful. So it's a very tough process, and DMR, frankly, deserves a tremendous amount of credit for the hard work and the rigor that they give it. So.
Representative Thorne.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wasn't getting off without a question from you.
That's the way I roll. I'm just curious, now, refresher course, how long a lease is? Does it depend on the species that you're...
It depends on two things. One is what the applicant chooses to apply for. And the second is what the law allows. So the applicant can choose to apply for a period shorter than what the law allows. The law allows for up to a 20-year lease.
Uh-huh.
We have people who apply for a 10-year lease. We have people who apply for a 20-year lease. The reason 20 years, and again, this legislative body was the group that approved that, was because we were having difficulty financing. Because think about if you finance your home on a 30-year mortgage versus a 5-year mortgage, they charge you a little difference on the interest rate, right? And so we used to have only 10-year lease applications, and particularly for our young growers, that was really difficult for them to get financing. And so that was why we went to the 20-year lease. And remember always that even though it's 20 years, it can be revoked at any time for cause.
And a follow-up for me? And just the Reader's Digest version, what do they look at for consideration to renew that lease, and what would be an example of a deal breaker?
Well, I would almost defer to Deirdre on that, but I will say this: you have to show that you were going to operate the lease in the manner and with the methods that it was originally approved for, right? So you can't substantively change what you're proposing to do at renewal. The interesting thing about the renewal process is even in the most contentious lease applications that we've had here in the state of, and we've been leasing since 1976 or 77, I think, or 74, the 70s, even in ones that have been incredibly contentious. And as an example, we've had them where we've had 3 days of hearings. Okay. So 3 full days of hearings before the DMR has all the evidence that it needs to consider whether or not to grant that lease or not. When those come up for renewal, there's virtually no opposition to renewal. What does that tell you? It tells you that that people, it's really fear of the unknown more than anything else, which is causing people to resist these leases. And once they get up and operating, they kind of become the neighborhood farm. Now, if we have an operator that is operating irresponsibly, you can be sure the people are going to show up at that renewal process and voice their opposition to renewal. And that happens I can think of only one instance where that's happened in the time that I've been around back in the state. So, you're held to the original purpose of the lease. You're held, your record is looked at. If you've had violations or what have you, that's going to play into it. And you need to obviously earn your stripes with the community you're in.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's great. Thank you so much. I'm sorry, Mr. Bell, one more. No, that's fine.
That was very rude.
No, it wasn't. I said, thank you very much. I just wanted to make sure your contact information is easy to get.
It's in the folder.
That's a little more specific than it needs to be for right now.
No worries. It's in the folder. My business card is in the folder. And you can probably.
Perfect. Thank you. Awesome. Okay. Next up, we've got the Island Institute.